information you're about to hear is true. The names of the brokerage firms and financial institutions have been changed to protect me, your host. This is Central PA. Every day, investors are encouraged to commit imprudent activity. Typical financial planners outnumber investor coaches 500 to 1. Just the facts, ma'am. Every day I get on the radio, I'm in danger. There is always someone who doesn't want you to hear what I have to say. Being an investor coach is a thankless, glamorous, endless job that has to be done, and I'm damn glad to do it. And now for our strategic spotlight segment. You're back with Coach's Corner, It's Your Money, Paul Nichols, and I'm real excited today because we have a special guest who's going to be on the radio with us, Barry Dyke. What I'm going to do is give a little bio of Barry, and we got him on the phone holding now, and then just read a quick excerpt from his book, and then we'll bring him on. I want to kind of get you in the frame of mind that you're going to get the most out of this show today. Let me give you a little input about Barry. By the way, I read his book. I guess it's been about a year ago, maybe, something like that. Definitely beginning of this year, and really enjoyed it. Of course, I enjoy anything that gives insight that you don't normally get in the mainstream press, and Barry has certainly taken time to do the research to produce a product, a book, that we can all glean some insight from. But Barry is an author. He's a consultant. He's a registered investment advisor and talk show guest. Since The Pirates of Manhattan, which is the name of his book, he's been a guest of many numerous TV and radio shows. The Pirates of Manhattan, The Systematic Plundering of the American Consumer and How to Protect It. His books are sold in all 50 states, Europe, Australia, England, and Singapore. The Pirates investigates and explains the root of the current financial crisis, rooted in excessive deregulation, over-leverage, and rampant speculation. The book will go on to explain why banks are extremely unstable in the American economy and why virtually all of the nation's largest banks invest billions of their critical reserves in high-value permanent life insurance. It's kind of interesting. It's timely that Barry's been talking about what's going on right now for quite a while. So it's nothing new in his mind's eye. But let me read an excerpt from his book that's going to kind of hopefully set the stage, and then we'll bring Barry on. Winston Churchill said, "This is about using life insurance to protect the economic value of human life. If I had my way, I would write the word insurance over the door of every house because I'm convinced that for the sacrifice, which are considerably small, families can be secured against catastrophes which would otherwise smash them up forever." The political commentator, humorist, and international celebrity Will Rogers said this, quote, "A man who dies without adequate life insurance should have to come back and see the mess he created." Rogers later died in 1935 in a plane crash in Barrow, Alaska, and life insurance benefits were one of the estate's largest and most important assets. So we're going to be talking about banking, life insurance, financial crisis, and I'd like to welcome my friend Barry Dykes. Barry, can you hear me?
Yes. Good morning, Paul.
How are
you? Good morning. Thank you. I can hear you well. Thank you, sir.
Good. Good. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I know you're a busy fella, and we've been waiting a while to get you on. And we just want to share some information with our listening audience, which is a fairly astute group. We're in a university town, and talk a little bit about your book. So let's.
Oh, by the way, you're in a university town, and it's kind of. Have you seen the YouTube clip I have on my website that I talk about life insurance products? How Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve's greatest banking patron, has most of his money in annuities.
Is that right?
yeah, it's all true.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because I have gotten some calls the last few weeks from clients, and I've gotten very few calls from my securities clients because we spend so much time educating them. I've gotten most of my calls from insurance clients. Unfortunately, a lot of people aren't aware how secure insurance is, and I hope we're going to talk a little bit about that today.
Sure.
But let's get into some preliminary information first, and that is The Pirates of Manhattan. What's it about?
Well, as Thomas Jefferson said, banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. And Al Capone once said, Wall Street, that's where the real crooks are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a... the thing is that we're in a similar period, and I hope really not in the Great Depression, okay, but we're in a period similar in time that We have over-leveraged, over-speculation, and deregulated banks. And where we are right now, it's no surprise to me, and certainly not to you, Paul.
But what prompted you to write it, Barry? And where did you get the inspiration for it? And were you just fed up, or did you say, "Hey,
well,
this is..."
I kind of went through a kind of crazy family event. I went through a divorce, which was very painful, and I had a kind of but there was kind of a spiritual base to it. But I was just tired because I had been successful in this business. I'd done work, with, public companies and privately held companies and some celebrities and things like that. And I was just getting tired of hearing that, things like life insurance is a bad thing when I, realized the truth was it's one of the best things anyone can own. But all the talking heads said the exact opposite.
Right. So was it the fact that there was all this misinformation that motivated you to write the book? Because I agree about insurance. It's one of the best investments people can make, but people don't understand that because they think of it as blood money. They think of it as just death.
Yes. And the thing is that the problem is that, unfortunately, folks do not read in this country anymore. But the fact of the matter is, I think you and I agree, is that actively managed mutual funds, while there have been a Klondike gold rush for these mutual fund companies and banks and Wall Street, they're actually very, very unstable, and no one knows what the future is going to bring, and no one knows what tax rates are going to be, and no one knows what the stock market. So this whole retirement system based upon dollar cost averaging and the whole thing is an illusion.
Right. I know we've talked about active managed funds, and I'm not a proponent of that at all. And when you talk about active managed, like Dalbar, you're familiar with Dalbar.
Yes.
They do a study every year on investor behavior, and the last report said that the average equity fund investor gets about 4% return.
Yeah. Bond fund, I think, actually does a little bit better, which kind of amazed me. Yeah, I cited that in my book. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Actually, you're better off investing in bonds than equities. But, so I was passionate in the sense that, because this turmoil is going ahead, and as we see it now, I mean, $700 billion, Paul, what do you think about that?
I'll tell you, it's ridiculous. I think it's all political, personally. I've never seen so much pork barrel spending right after a debate where they talked about cutting spending. I've been talking about it. It's all political to me. It's just more entitlement programs or moving us closer to a socialized state. But I don't know. I haven't studied the banking industry like you have. I do know that a lot of people, especially my older clients, are under the impression that banks are very safe, and I've always asked them why, and they say, well, because of FDIC. Well, what's the I stand for in FDIC? Stands for insurance. But let's talk a little bit about the banking thing, because you have more insight than I do.
Yes.
What do you think? Obviously, we know that the subprime lending created this, and people that shouldn't have been getting loans, and so on and so forth. But why is there such a battle cry from these credit institutions to have this bailout happen?
Well, because they're extremely over-leveraged, and they're horrendous managers of economic risk. And people that question me on this, just look at the Argentine debt crisis, the savings loan crisis, and so forth. Unfortunately, banks, for the most part, are transactional in nature, and they really even hold that many loans on their own books anymore. They made it all in the fees and stuff, and selling these things out and packaging them. So the reason why we are where we are right now is the banks are, they're not very good economic managers of economic risk. But also, one of the problems has been that the Federal Reserve System, which is not federal, has flooded the economy with cheap money, and which ignited essentially a speculation crisis. And this is similar to what happened during the 1920s, before the Great Crash. And so, by flooding the economic system with cheap money, we encourage speculation. We encourage disintermediation. In other words, we push money into the markets, and by creating vast sums of money, Paul, we create massive amounts of inflation. So people even push more into the pool because their value of their savings is going down. So creates more speculation. It gets back to the banking, and the key thing, the linchpin of this whole thing, is that the Federal Reserve System, which everyone thinks is part of the federal government, is not. It's got as much in common as Federal Express does.
Well, let's talk about that, Barry, because that's one of the biggest revelations I got from your book was about the Federal Reserve. Tell people the story about how that started back in the early 1900s, right?
Yeah, came out of when 1907, when there was a major crash, and these economic crashes are nothing new in American history, but J.P. Morgan was essentially, and he wasn't a nice guy, by the way, but they wanted to have a, what is called an elastic currency, so these bankers wouldn't be on the hook when there was an economic calamity, because back in the old days, Andrew Jackson, God bless him, he killed the private bank. And this is one of the founding fathers' greatest fears was having a private central bank, and Thomas Jefferson and so on. But in any event, it was essentially created it was essentially conceived off the coast of Georgia on Jekyll Island, I think around November of 1910, 1911, thereabouts, and to get a private bank to control the money supply. And since that time, it was signed into law on Christmas Eve in 1913, and by Woodrow Wilson. And before Woodrow Wilson died, he immensely regretted that he actually partook in the creation of the Federal Reserve. And since that time, really, the banks, really, the private financiers, really had control of the monetary system. And I didn't know this either, Paul. You know, I was just kind of a quest, and but it's all a matter of public record.
Well, you know, if you were a conspiracy theorist of sorts, which I guess sometimes I may sound like that because I'm so contrarian in certain things, what you're saying is there's some pretty wealthy individuals that we would all know their names, and a lot of people have heard of Jekyll Island and kind of the think tanks and all the kind of crooked things that that came from that because of these guys controlling money. But there were some pretty wealthy individuals, industrialists at that time, I would assume, that decided.
Rockefeller and Harriman's and Vanderlip and all these guys, and National City, which is the precursor to today's Citigroup and so forth. Yeah, so you can, and the Warburgs, which is, you know, from Daddy Warbucks,
right.
And it's a great, but it's all fact.
So these guys basically got together and said, hey, we want to privatize our Federal Reserve.
Yeah, and so so the fact of the matter is that the Federal Reserve is owned by the individual Federal Reserves. There's one in Philly, am I correct? And which is a pretty big one. Mm-hmm. And so you have the Philly and Boston, Atlanta, and the rest of them. Okay, so but the Philly banks are owned by your individual commercial banks within PA. PA is a big banking state.
Sure,
I found that out when I'm doing research in this book. So the commercial banks on the regional feds, and the feds, Federal Reserve banks on the Federal Reserve system. So the Fed always works in behavior of really in favor of the banks first, and this is why helicopter Ben Bernanke, who was flooding the economy, really works in the benefit of the bankers first, and not necessarily the taxpayer.
Yeah, and so when I understanding that, having read your book last year, this bailout just it becomes that much more of an insult in my mind, because really what we're doing is bailing out. We want to use the excuse of bailing out Main Street, but we're not necessarily per se bailing out Wall Street. All of us are part of Wall Street, really, if you have any investments. But
yeah.
Are we really bailing out the big bank guys?
Yeah, we are. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, it's just, a lot of this stuff is not just the bankers, Paul. I mean, it's a story of greed, which is old as man. And if you study civilizations and the fall of civilizations, you know, you find the fall of Spain and Rome and all these other countries were essentially brought about by speculation and wars.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Well, hopefully we're not to that point. I like to consider myself the eternal optimist, and I've been talking about it. Things aren't as bad. The crisis isn't as dire as they're making out. Obviously, we need to get some influx of cash. You know, the thing that's confused me about this whole deal, Barry, maybe you can shed some insight, is all this came from the loans. I'm going to read some articles later in the show about the percentage of subprimes and what have you, but they're making like the real estate that collateralizes these mortgage-backed loans isn't worth anything.
That's not true.
I know. That's what's got me so confused. All of a sudden, they're worth nothing, but yet they're collateralized by all the real estate that originally was used to for the mortgages.
Yeah, it's yeah. But the thing is that because of the deregulation of the banks and going back to Basel II, which is another going to be another shooter drop, and which Basel II is going to essentially let banks and essentially it's passed, okay, and you know it's one of those things where you had to search for it, but Basel II. Anyone Google it, okay? They were letting banks determine their own reserves, and part of Basel II was saying if you make AAA credit, then you can have less reserves, and so the rating agencies were involved in this too. So it's interesting stuff.
Well, you know what is interesting? I was listening to the news last night while I was playing with my kids and my 11-year-old daughter. When I heard this, the bill had passed, I just kind of grumbled under my breath, and she goes, "What's the matter?" I said, "Honey, that's something you're going to be, your kids are going to be paying for right there." What just happened yesterday. But anyway, as it relates to the book, The Pirates of Manhattan, The Systematic Plundering of the American Investor, I'm curious, what was the most amazing discovery that you made? Because you did a tremendous amount of research. I know that you've been on TV shows and radio shows and what have you, and you have a successful firm up in New England. But what was the most the biggest revelation you had when you were putting this together?
The banks, which are the avatars of the market, don't put their money in the market. They put their money into... And I'll give you some examples. The banks, for the most part, for all their wisdom, put their money into high cash value life insurance.
Yeah, I've heard that term before. A lot of people may not be familiar with BOLI. What does BOLI mean?
BOLI is an acronym for bank owned life insurance. And the banks, most of the banks, some of the banks own so much life insurance, they're actually bigger than a lot of life insurance companies themselves. And
how has that affected them, Barry, with this current credit crunch?
Well, it really hasn't affected them at all. It's actually, it's very, very, when you look at the economics, okay, and these guys are not dummies, okay, when you look at the economics, it's actually a very smart thing to do, because they're looking at really from a macro point of view and seeing that they have to have money in safe and reserve somewhere. And so these guys are not idiots, and so they put it there for a number of reasons. That, you know, it improves their income statement. There's as the cash value increases, it improves their income statement for Wall Street. They know everyone's going to die. When the money dies, they get a very large benefit into their account, income tax free. They know the life companies are more stable than a bank, because life companies are not over leveraged like these troubled banks. It's an ideal funding medium for these high end pensions that these financiers have. So there's a lot of good things, and the thing is, even a treasury bill won't do that. And I'm not against treasuries, okay? And I'm not against funds or investments, but when you look at every house needs a foundation, Paul, and so this is the money resides in their tier one reserves, which is the most important part of any bank.
So when you say when you look at bank owned life insurance, I know it's a massive numbers. I mean it's billions. That they have in insurance. And so what you're saying is it's ironic that the banks, if I'm not mistaken, can loan out $12 for every dollar they take in. It's something like that. I forget what the number is. But with life insurance, that's totally different. So the life insurance is one of the bigger assets that they have on their books, and it doesn't have the same type of requirements. In other words, the requirements in banking are much looser.
Yeah, well, that's all. The life insurance industry is much tighter than the banks are. The banks are, I mean, they're crazy. I mean, if you look at Citigroup, they're all crying about this whole Wachovia deal. I mean, Citigroup has done a horrible job of managing money, and whereas life companies, I mean, it's very, very strict, Paul, as you know. I mean, and this all goes back to 1905, the Armstrong Commission, because it's not the first time financiers are getting problems, and so the Armstrong Commission back in 1905 essentially set the rules really for most life insurance companies today, which is, means that life companies have to be managed very, very well, so they have 70-80% of the money is in AAA bonds and mortgages. You know, you've looked at the portfolios, Paul, so they have to be very, very tight. Whereas banks are, and they do lend money out, but they're 100% reserve based, whereas banks are fractional reserve based. So just from a mechanical point of view, a life company will always be more stable than a bank.
Well, and could you make the statement then before we go to break that because the bank owns so much life insurance, and because of the strict body that governs that, whether it be the National Association of Insurance Commissioners or other bodies, that that one of their safer investments that the bank has is actually not the people that have borrowed money, but actually the money they have in the cash value life insurance?
Oh, there's no question about it. Matter of fact, if we're going to take a break, we can I just pull up some of these latest numbers. You have a couple of banks based in your home state, Sovereign?
Yeah, Sovereign. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'll just to give some people some facts. And so I'm a doubting Thomas, so the truth is the truth. And thank you for having me on your show, because I love talk radio, because it's one of the only ways to get the truth out in this country.
Yeah, well, when we come back, we're going to get into to some of those numbers, and we're going to talk about why life insurance is good and what does make it safe. So stay with us. So we'll be right back with It's Your Money, part of Coach's Corner, Saturday Morning Street Smart. We are back with It's Your Money. My name is Paul Nichols, your host of Coach's Corner, our third segment. We have a special guest on today, Barry Dyke. Barry Dyke is a best-selling author of The Pirates of Manhattan. Hey, Barry, you know, I wanted to back up and talk a little bit about how insurance works so that people get a better idea of how to structure it, because most people just think of insurance as being, they would buy a, they come in with a check and say, I want the most death benefit. So a lot of times it's the way people structure insurance. And so they may have a disconnect because they may not understand that we use it in a more sophisticated way than a lot of people think of insurance. So maybe we can chat a little bit about that. And then I wanted to give you a pat on the back. I'm quite impressed that you've been able to create this book, make it a bestseller, and it be self-published.
It hasn't been easy, Paul.
You must be, your tongue must be hanging out over there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a lot of work. And, you know, it's as you know, the book's not just about life insurance. It's trying to give people just an overview as to what's really going on in the economy. So I just know if a consumer puts their money in a life company, it's the safest place that I know of in America. And, you know, reaffirm that was that this is where the banks put their money.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about safety first, and then let's get into structure. Why is life insurance? Now, by the way, I have 2/3 of my personal investments in life insurance, about 1/3 in the market. Why is insurance so safe?
Well, because, as I say, because first of all, it's regulated by state laws, and state laws are, I'm kind of going back to the states' rights. Each state, like you're in Pennsylvania, so each state has very specific laws as to how life insurance, if they do business in the state of Pennsylvania, how they can do business. So, in other words, first of all, from a portfolio management point of view, the life companies really don't have the leeway. Okay, someone like a Goldman Sachs, they are essentially a gigantic hedge fund. But conversely, a life company cannot do that. They have to have a very, very stable portfolio of essentially high quality AAA bonds and so forth, in cash and treasury bills, some real estate, maybe a little bit mortgages. You know, so from a structural point of view, they have to have a very strong portfolio. Whereas And it has to be managed 10, 15, 20 years out. Whereas a bank, they just really look for the next quarter, particularly if they're publicly traded, okay? I'm a snob, as you know. In life insurance, I like the mutual companies, but you can educate people on that later. But so from that point of view, they're very, very strong just from a portfolio management point of view, and because these banks were having all these derivatives and so forth, and the life companies, and I've talked to CEOs, a lot of life companies, as a result of doing this book, and their exposure to these derivatives is minimal. It's minuscule.
So basically, their underlying investments are much more
very,
liquid.
Yeah, very solid and strong, okay?
Yeah, and it's just not fluff on paper.
Exactly. So they hit from a portfolio point of view, there's a lot of rules and regulations, okay? Whereas there hasn't been really too many rules and regulations with banks or investment banks or mutual funds, so actually manage one. So you have that for a point of view. Secondly, a life company, you know, is more or less, it looks like a bank because they are a depository, a larger major depositors of people's wealth, and they do lend money out for construction projects, skyscrapers, and so forth. But the thing is, if a life company lends money out to the public, it's 100% reserve-based. So in other words, they have $1 billion in assets, Paul would say. Generally, a life company is only going to lend out 90% of that, $900 million, whereas if you have $1 billion with a bank, they're going to lend or like a regular bank, like say Sovereign, if you will, they're going to lend at least a minimum $10 billion. And if you're something like Citigroup, you're going to be lending out $17 billion. So from a structural point of view, life companies are always because they're safer because there's not as much leverage.
So they can't really overextend themselves. In
exactly.
essence, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and this is with these Bear Stearns and all, they were leveraged 30-40 to 1, Paul. So
yeah,
they just one bad trade away from collapse.
You know, I've been making some pretty bold statements to clients, and I've even made this statement on the radio. I haven't been able to find, and I know you've done a lot more extensive research than I have, a policyholder, not a shareholder, but a policyholder in fixed or whole life, not variable life, but in life insurance, that has lost money. But I'll talk to an old codger, so to speak, and he'll say, well, I had this company back in 1950 and that defaulted. And
it's obviously a concern. No, that's true in Canada, by the way. I throw United States and Canada in every search, and I haven't been able to find anyone either. So again, I go back to the great pundit, Will Rogers. We know what Will Rogers said about life insurance? He said, I'm not so concerned about the return on my money, but the return of my money.
Right.
Okay. And that's right. Again, Will Rogers was a big believer in life insurance. But and the thing is that if a life insurer does business in, say, in Pennsylvania, you may have like Guardian, New York Life, and Mass Mutual, and all these other companies, okay, they participate in what is called a legal reserve system. So if there is a failure, and we don't know, Paul, neither of us is God, and if there is a failure, the participating insurers have to essentially bail out the failing insurer. So which is great for the taxpayer, because the taxpayer is not paying this.
So what happens when, and I know there's very few scenarios, but what happens when an insurance company defaults to the policyholders of that company?
Well, essentially, it's assumed by the legal reserve companies who are doing business in that state, and okay. No one likes it, but essentially, they'll pitch in. So in other words, if one company's doing 5% or 3%, so they're essentially reinsure that the default. The life company, so there's no government involvement, and it works.
Well, you know, it's interesting that one of the first calls I made after the AIG debacle, which I happen to be a policyholder of AIG, one of the first calls I made was to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which, for people out there, that represents the 50 states. Each state has an insurance commissioner, and I got nothing but reassurance from them. In fact, they had put out a press release the following day, stating how in their 135-year existence, this is no big deal. They got guaranteed funds and so on and so forth. So not only do a lot of insurance companies are reinsured, but they also have state regulatory bodies that have coffers. And like in the state of Pennsylvania, for every premium that comes in, 80% has got to be kept in reserve.
Yeah. So the thing is, and the life companies even, I mean, I've gotten emails from various life companies, you know, this whole... No one wants to trash up AIG, and I don't think really anyone wants to. And the fact of the matter, the AIG as an insurance company is actually run very, very well.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Very, very well. And the problem was their investment bank and the derivatives.
Mm-hmm. It was really
the shop in London, and that's what ruined them. And there's all this, and so it's actually a very well run business.
Yeah, it's really kind of the way the books are kept now. That kind of screwed things up, which we'll talk a little bit later on. Well, you know, before we go to the top of the hour break, let's talk a little bit about structuring. I know your book's not just about life insurance. It's about mutual funds. It's about a lot of things, but I really want to focus on this because this is what's on most people's minds. When we talk about structuring of life insurance, it's not, let's say you walked into my office and said, Paul, I want to insure myself for my family's benefit. You know, here's $500 a month, for example. What's the largest death benefit I can get?
Yeah.
That's the way most people understand life insurance.
Yeah,
it's simply something for them.
Yeah.
So give them a little idea of the structure. We don't need to get into TAMRA, TEF, or DEFRA and all that.
All that stuff, yeah. No, well, essentially the idea is that, it's good for everybody. The idea is really to maximize the cash value portion of the policy and minimize the death benefit. Because and really to make the life policy, it's when people read my book and if they're listening, they should go on the website www.thepiratesofmanhattan.com because that gives you more videos and so forth to back this stuff up. But the idea really is to maximize the economic benefits of the life insurers as a power tool, like the banks. So really, the idea is really to maximize the cash value and minimize the death benefit. And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with term life insurance and all that stuff, but really, as a way really to save your money. And this is, ironically, this is something like our parents used to do and old life policies used to do. They used to be endowments and the whole thing. And so a lot of this stuff is really, what I'm preaching about is it's just kind of a remedy which has happened in days past.
Well, give me some more input to this statement and just to kind of clarify what you're saying. When we talk about overfunding a policy or creating cash value, instead of going in and asking for the largest death benefit, we want the smallest death benefit because we want the death benefit, but that's not the major focus when we're looking at it from an accumulation or retirement viewpoint. One of the advantages that I see about life insurance and why I have a fair amount in it is because when I pull the money out, I can't access that money tax-free. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And you can take it out as a loan, and the values and deposits secure your loan. Matter of fact, there's a great piece in the Wall Street Journal how it's an emergency fund. Coachman Industries, which is one of the large RV, I don't know if you saw this in the Journal a couple months back, Paul, but
no.
Coachman Industries was one of the large RV manufacturers in the world, out of Indiana or thereabouts,
yeah,
in the Midwest somewhere.
Yeah.
Says it took a $22 million loan against their life insurance policies to keep the company buoyant in these economic times. So what I'm saying is these guys are very, very smart. So they kept the money in a rainy day fund, so now they have essentially a guaranteed line of credit to help them out. And, you know, there's been numerous, and then, of course, I don't know if your listeners know about the Walt Disney story.
No, tell them the story.
Well, the truth be told is that in 1952, when Walt wanted to create a clean theme park, and everyone said no one could do that. Everyone said you gotta get served liquor, and at that time amusement parks were dirty places with liquor and cranky old Ferris wheels, and they were awful. You know, and Walt was in the animation business, but Walt really had this vision of having a nice, clean theme park where people could bring their families. And everyone said, including his brother Roy, and he was very, very close to his brother Roy, he said, Roy said, Walt, you're nuts. You can't do this. No one's going to pay to get into a theme park. So Walt essentially talked to his bankers and everyone else, and everyone turned him down. Every single last person turned him down, even his brother. He said, Walt, we're in the animation business. So Walt, being the persistent guy that he was, he had a vacation home in Palm Springs, California. He got some various loans from some of his employees, but the majority of it, the investment, the seed money for Walt Disney Corporation as we know it today, came from a life insurance loan in 1952. Walt pulled out $100,000 out of his life insurance and to fund a piece by Stanford Research Institute. They did the groundwork studies for Anaheim and so forth, and it came with the master plan. And so the whole Disney world really is found in a life insurance loan. And
you know that,
that's his history. And then he made all his money in going to television and so forth.
Sure, yeah, I know he was into animation. That's how he got his start. But that's interesting. You know, a lot of people don't realize that. Now, you have to do this on purpose when you set these policies up. And we need to go to a break here in about 30 seconds. But when we come back, let's talk about how corporations use these for executive, deferred executive pension plans and what have you. But in essence, what we're doing, folks, to kind of wrap your head around this, is we're doing just the opposite of what you would normally do with insurance, in that we're going in and throwing a lot of money in there and letting that build up, because we can pull that money out tax-free. And then if something happens to you along the way, the death benefit, of course, is going to quadruple or blossom and then pass on to your heirs. Well, hey, we have Barry Dyke on the line with the author of The Pirates of Manhattan. We're going to go to our hard break at the top of the hour, and right past that, we're going to bring Barry back and get into some more about the systematic plundering of the American investor. This is Coach's Corner. It's your money. Okay, folks, we are back. This is Paul Nichols, the investor coach with It's Your Money, and we are joined by Barry Dyke, the best-selling author of The Pirates of Manhattan. I just wanted to mention, I've had a few conversations with Barry, and I'll tell you that he's very passionate, not only about promoting his book, and that's obvious, you need to do that, especially when you self-publish a book, but he's very passionate about educating consumers. And I can tell in the time that I've spent with him that we both share the frustration of the way the industry works and the lack of information, or the preponderance of misinformation that really leads a lot of people awry. And these people are often our mothers, our grandmothers, our aunts, and people that just, you know, finance may not be their vocation, so they have to go and rely on people. And there's a lot to be said about the corruption in the financial services industry, huh, Barry?
Yeah, this is a tremendous amount. And, you know, I've been in the it's awful. And, I think most people are, I think most advisors are really good people. And I do, for the most part, the problem is that the it's very institutions they work for. They don't want to educate people about this stuff. but there's a lot of corruption at the top end.
You know, I say it all the time. A lot of brokers are good guys and gals out there. The problem is, like when I was with major broker dealers, they never taught us anything but how to sell. I mean, they never taught us, really wanted to dig down and educate on you know, how you develop a diversified portfolio and what do you use and so on and so forth. It was all about use this technique or use this piece of information or that type of thing. Have you found that to be the case in your own career?
Yeah, and all these sales ideas and all that stuff. And the thing is, let's look at it. Let's face it, Paul. We're dealing with people's economic lives and the family unit. We're dealing with families. Family is, you know, is a business unto itself, and it should be looked at as a business. And, We got to, you know, really love and help and care about our clients, but the institutions just want to have us to sell them all these products, and it's sad. But the thing is that even a lot of the advisors, and I was a high advisor myself, I really didn't know a lot about this stuff until I started digging and said, "What's going on here?" And I totally knew something was wrong, and the facts are really just covered up, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask you, give folks your website again, Barry.
www.thepiratesofmanhattan.com. Excuse me, www.thepiratesofmanhattan.com. And even if people don't get the book, they go to visit the site, go to the video archive or Barry's broadcast, they'll get an education.
Now, and then you can also go to our website, which we have here, Barry's book featured in our recommended reading. Now, if they want to go about buying the book, how do they, I mean, they can give our local folks, you can just give our office a call, and we have books that we'll pass on to you for the same cost we paid for them. We're not making money off of them. Can they go to Amazon? I don't think they can do that. They have to go through you, right?
Because the reason is that the margin, you know, the book is great for the ego, but there's not a lot of money in the books. I understand that. Everyone said there wasn't, but they were right, and I didn't want to believe them. But, when the book came out, like a week after it came out, because we have the ISBN number and so forth, Amazon just immediately discounted it like 40-50%. I said, holy moly, they want me to sell it at my cost. And it's like, so no, I've decided really not. I don't know. It may be brought up by another major publisher. I haven't decided yet. But no Amazon. Although, the book is $37.95 on my website, but it's actually selling used on Barnes & Noble and Amazon for as much as like $240 used, Paul.
Wow. Well, you know, we're looking at the website right now, so they can go on the website and buy the book, piratesofmanhattan.com. You know, before we get into, I wanted to talk a little bit more about bank-owned life insurance and corporate-owned life insurance, because
sure.
I think it paints the picture and gives people indication, hey, the big boys have been in this deal for quite a while. But before we get into that, can you just spend a couple minutes talking about this concept of the value of life? I found this very interesting in your book.
Well, the greatest value of them all is the human life. I think most people would agree, and over from a spiritual or even economic point of view, really, you know, if you take away the man, you have nothing. And unfortunately, in this country, we spend more money insuring our possessions than we do the value of human life.
Isn't that amazing?
And it's true, and all my statistics show that life insurance purchases are going down, which is sad. But really, the greatest the economic piece there is. I mean, look at Walt Disney. Look at Warren Buffett. Okay, where would Berkshire Hathaway be without Warren Buffett? So in any event, he loves life insurance, by the way, and he owns a lot of it indirectly. So, but the thing is that, you know, if someone is to die, really, you want to have as much money as you possibly can. So what occurred to me is that, you know, the government's already been in the life insurance business for years, and what occurred to me, but it's the best example I know of life insurance, was the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund, which was the 9/11 crash, the World Trade Center tragedy, which was essentially a $6 billion life insurance payment, which it was, because mm-hmm. It was all income tax-free, and it was all based upon the economic value of human life. And so when we were, you know, people really need to think of the ideal, really, to replace, if I was to die, will be the replacement value. And this is what the courts of law are doing in wrongful death and so forth. I have a friend of mine, John Scarborough, who is a PhD in economics. He supports all this stuff. But this is where we need to think. And this is what the World Trade Center 9/11 victims compensation was, a $6 billion life insurance payment based upon the economic value of human life.
Yeah, they actually had picked those numbers, right, when they went to the commission.
Yeah, and it was really weird, because it was kind of information hidden, and thank God for the internet, and I Googled the guy and who had this website Fix the Fund, and he was kind enough to pass it on to me, because the stuff really wasn't, it's in the public domain, although it's kind of closed down now. But yeah, it's all life insurance, because all the money was income tax free. So if you were trading stocks and bonds on the 101st floor of the World Trade Center, you know, you could get $7 million in life insurance benefits.
Yeah, but for the family, you know, right.
Which it was.
Yeah, and I know that it helped a lot, and it's mentioned in your book. You know, and we're just talking about the death part of it, but
yeah.
A lot of us like you that use life insurance in many different ways. We just don't use it as life insurance. I personally use it for my retirement plan. I use it for my bank. In fact, you know, if we build cash value up in a policy, and when we go to buy a vehicle, Nelson Nash is going to be on next month. You know, Nelson's friend of yours.
He's a wonderful man.
Yeah, he wrote a book called The Infinite Banking Concept, or Bank on Yourself. And the idea is whenever we need a car or a major purchase, we go into the life insurance policy, pull the money out, buy the vehicle, and then we pay ourselves back the same interest we would have paid to the finance company back to the policy.
Something our parents did.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that life insurance is just not about death. It can be about retirement, tax-free income, college funding, major purchases. But until you get with the guy or a gal that really understands this, you think of and
yeah,
they don't teach this. I mean, I've had to learn this.
By the media and everyone else. And matter of fact, I mentor young men, and I'm actually teaching a course like next Friday. It's for disabled people about money and. May lead to adult education, but it unfortunately, it's my term invested differences. This never works, and
why is that? So, why does not that? Because they don't invest the money like they're supposed to, right?
People don't. They invest and speculate the difference. You know?
Yeah, right. Well, and
they
that's
lose what, it.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting? I'm in both camps. We've talked about that before. I'm in the securities camp. I talk a lot about that on the radio, an academic approach to investing, and I'm in the insurance camp. But most people in the industry are in one camp or the other, I've noticed, and it seems like if they're in the securities camp, they don't want you putting money in insurance because it gives them less money to speculate and gamble with.
Yeah, and the whole funny thing is I have that chapter, never met a man who made millions of mutual funds. The fact is I've been very blessed, Paul, in my career, and I've met a lot of guys, some worth nothing, some worth over $100 million, you know, $200 million, okay? And none of these guys have made their money in mutual funds, you know, actively managed mutual funds. So most people, you know, made investing in themselves, and, you know, and I'm not against the market, it's a big, actively managed mutual funds is a big business now for advisors, and I'm not against it. It's just they need to, unfortunately, you know, and it's hard because I have friends who manage money, and I said, Barry, darn it, you called it, and, you know, they manage some money, some major mutual fund companies, so. I'm not against it, but people need a foundation.
Well, and there's a lot of misinformation about the securities industry. Let's focus in. We've talked a little bit about safety and how you can structure these policies a little differently, the value of life. Let's talk a little bit about more of the corporate-owned life insurance and how that's and then you have some statistics on banks as well. But let's talk a little bit about the banks' investment life insurance in corporations and how these a lot of these bigwigs at corporations have these have a lot of their pension plans or buyouts in insurance.
Okay, well, let's just get down, because I just think of a couple banks in your back neighborhood, Mellon, Bank of New York Mellon, which is the Mellon family, one of the oldest banking dynasties of the world, PNC, and maybe Sovereign, but most people don't realize this, but Bank of New York Mellon, which is, you know, it's not ninth largest bank in the United States now. They have a net worth of Tier 1 cap about $10.4 billion, and out of that $10.4 billion, $2.6 billion of that is invested in life insurance,
wow.
Which means that 30% of your Bank of New York is invested in life insurance. And as a matter of fact, I also did a survey of all the assets they own, skyscrapers and bank premises and computer equipment and other assets. They only have, about... I have it right here. It's up $1.3 billion. So Bank of New York Mellon, who essentially pushes, you know, asset management, has 25% of their money invested in life insurance and only 13% of their money invested in hard assets. Anyone thinks of banks like this and the same thing. Another example is, say, Sovereign, which is part of Bank Santander of Spain. They have a net worth of about $5.8 billion. $1.8 billion of Sovereign is invested in life insurance. So, in other words, 31% of Sovereign is invested in life insurance, okay? Now, get this. Sovereign and their hard assets, you know, all the bank premises and so forth, only has about $647 million invested in real estate and hard assets, and everyone thinks so only 11% of Sovereign is invested in hard assets, and 31% of the life insurance, 31% of Sovereign Bank, which is one of the major banks in the United States, is invested in life insurance.
That's amazing. I had no idea that they had, 25 to 35% of their assets. I knew there was a lot, but I didn't realize it was that significant. Well, let's talk about corporations. And more to executive.
Because it's still a major part of, roughly, my figures are about roughly 1,600 or so publicly traded companies generally have deferred compensation or selective executive pension plans for themselves. In reviewing literally hundreds of proxy statements, Paul, from my research, every single one of them is based upon an annuity methodology or some type of life credit methodology to fund an executive pension plan. And I would say probably a vast majority in Clark Consulting, who's now owned by Aegon, whatever, 60-70% of the executive pensions in the United States are funded in life insurance or annuities or in some shape or form. They all use the annuity methodology, and annuity, which comes out of life companies. And our whole Social Security system and a whole defined benefit pension plans, which in the state of Pennsylvania and throughout the country and the federal, even Social Security, are based upon life insurance principles. So, but most of the corporations do have some type of selective benefits. Great example would be, let's take General Electric, which is the largest industrial company in the world, and often considered the most successful, although with their credit, GE credit is not too good right now. GE has over 4,400, I repeat, 4,400 executives in selective life insurance programs. So at one point, guys like Jack Welch, who was the CEO of General Electric, had GE was spending over $1 million a year just on his life insurance premiums.
Wow.
So that's another example.
So we see it quite a bit in the corporate when you look at compensation plans they buy substantial life insurance for these compensation plans. And what's the motivation for them using life insurance so much? For example, here in Pennsylvania State College, we have Penn State University. They have Tia Kraft, and then we have the Peasers, the retired state employees. And all of them use annuities for accumulation for their retirement plans. Is it because of the safety? That's why so many corporations and universities and different outfits use the life insurance?
Yeah, because it's very safe. I mean, it's mathematically, and I like things which are built very, very well and engineered well, which are strong, which can really withstand any economic condition. And the fact of the matter is, if the actuaries are very conservative guys. The definition of an actuary is a CPA without a sense of humor, and the thing is that they're very, very safe, and because it comes annuity, which means you can to live your whole life, and I guess it goes back to the Greek or Latin word, and mm-hmm. And essentially that's really been the foundation. And matter of fact, annuities, great example. Babe Ruth invested heavily in annuities, and he loved them because during the Great Depression, he just kind of sailed through.
Yeah.
Because he put all his money in annuities, and the money with life companies that remained 99.9% safe during the Great Depression, this is true, whereas 10,000 banks failed.
Unbelievable. You know, with the few minutes that we have left, Barry, I know we've talked a lot about the positives of insurance, how safe it is, and how corporations and banks use it. Let's take just a few minutes and look at it from more of the double advocate or the pessimist viewpoint.
Sure.
What's the downside? What's the caveat? What's the catch? Where's the hook?
Well, it's obviously something you don't want to do, it's something you don't really just want to do for 1 year or 2 years, whatever. Forget it, okay? And the thing is, if people are just thinking that, if they think of this get-rich-quick scheme, it doesn't work, okay?
So it's a long-term strategy.
It's a long-term strategy, okay? It's like, getting education or having a small business, it's a long-term commitment, okay? And it works. If there's commitment and there's patience and there's discipline, it's going to serve you wonderfully, okay? If you're trying to pick the hottest stock, from Jim Cramer, you know, go to Disneyland, okay? I mean, that's people get crunched in that stuff. So,
well, you know, I'm not a big fan of Jim Cramer. I've spoken of him as the Antichrist of investing, but
his track record is horrible.
It is horrible, but you know, it's entertainment. We call it investainment. But let me ask you this. Okay, so long term, I guess the other negative you could say would be funding it, but of course it's pretty flexible when it comes to that. So you need to have somebody qualified to sit down with.
You need someone who knows what they're doing, and you know, and it takes some time in that. I mean, someone like yourself or whatever, Paul. I mean, you're an RIA, so you obviously know what you're doing, and I kind of like the independent guy too. I don't like, you know, anyone who's really tied to a major institution.
Well, because you know you're handcuffed to them, like I was at one point. They are going to dictate to you because you're an employee.
Yeah, and you know? So you really want someone to understand just about life insurance or investments, but really know something about economics, and you know, it's pretty well read. And so the downside really is that. You know, give the downside. It's something you really don't want to do in the year. There's a problem with life insurance. It is a privileged product. I mean, you have to qualify for it. But when you understand the economics of the product, like someone Nelson Nash will have as a guest, okay, you understand the economics of life insurance. Even if someone's uninsurable, you can use your wife, or your children, or whatever, as a bank. So, people, you know, so it's a commitment, and you know, it's not for everybody, but when you really understand it, it's an awesome way to go.
It's a great vehicle. Well, we're about out of time here, Barry. I wanted to thank you for your time. Encourage people to go to thepiratesofmanhattan.com. You can pick up a book through Barry's site, check out some of the information he has on there, or go ahead and go to our site, financialabundancing.com, or stop by the office, and we got copies in the office. I really want to thank you for taking some of your Saturday morning, Barry. I know you have family and lots of things to do. So I really appreciate you spending some time with folks in central Pennsylvania. And hopefully you'll see some orders come. I want to strongly encourage anyone listening, if you want to pull your head out of the sand and really get educated about what's going on, this is a great place to start with this book. I gleaned a tremendous amount of information from it. And I had no idea about the 9/11 or Walt Disney or a lot of these other things that we've talked about. So I want to strongly promote the book and encourage people to seek out Barry. Barry, is there any fleeting notes or last minute thoughts you want to share with the listeners?
Well, yeah, everyone remembers Henry Ford, and just to educate people about themselves about the banking system going on. And Henry Ford said this, gee whiz, probably 80 years ago. He said that if people really understood the banking system, the Federal Reserve, I have no doubt there'd be revolution in the streets by tomorrow morning. And the thing is that what Henry Ford wanted to educate people about was how the banks really work. Because when people, when they understand more about how banks and things really work, they really realize how well served they'll be by someone like yourself who's dedicated to the truth and so forth.
Well, hey, Barry, we want to thank you for your time. I really do appreciate you taking the time, and I hope folks out there, you've gotten some insight from all the knowledge that Barry's accrued. And I'm sure we'll be in touch with you down the road, Barry. So thanks so much for taking your morning and spending it with us. And we're going to be right back with It's Your Money, Coach's Corner.